Greetings and corpsifications, my excellent listeners, and welcome to this July 2012 Science News Update. I'm your host for this shiny and fresh science podcast, Jim Campanella. Oh, I've got some amazing stories to report to you tonight. Seems like the middle of the year is a time when the really cool things start to get reported. Let me start with a story that sounds like something from World War Z, or Night of the Living Dead for that matter. The definition of actual death for an individual has shifted back and forth in the last couple of decades as we learn more about biology and genetics and neurophysiology. But neuropathologist Dr. Fabrice Chrétien at the Pasteur Institute has now thrown the worlds of medicine and law into a complete loop with his report in late June in the journal Nature Communications. Dr. Chrétien has discovered that some populations of stem cells can stay alive in corpses for 17 days after the individual has died. The really creepy bit is that 17 days dead may not be the upper limit. The upper limit may even be higher than that, because 17 days is just how old the remains being tested were. Chrétien could not get anything older at the time of his work. Chrétien wanted to learn whether stem cells could remain viable inside the body after death. Previously, it was considered unlikely that stem cells would survive longer than 2 days without fresh oxygen and nutrients. However, tests on the 17-day-old remains, which were stored at a cool 39 degrees Fahrenheit, that's just barely above refrigerator temps, turned up living stem cells. Specifically, they found skeletal muscle stem cells. The cells were alive, but in an inactive state. That makes sense, since it may be the only way for living cells to survive in an environment which is pretty hostile to continued survival. The isolated stem cells could give rise specifically to skeletal muscle, and not to any other type of muscle. So they were sort of limited. However, Chrétien stated, quote, "A better understanding of this dormancy could help lead to new ways to help keep stem cells viable for longer periods for therapeutic purposes. They could also shed light on how cells in general respond to injuries and other traumas," unquote. If you remember from previous science updates, stem cells are multipotent parental cell lineages that can give rise to other cells in the body. That's a property that makes them extraordinarily valuable in all sorts of potential genetic therapies. These multipotent cells are often rare and only present in small numbers in tissue samples from live patients, and difficult to distinguish from other cell types in many cases. Because they're so hard to get a hold of, Chrétien was investigating novel ways to procure stem cells and improve the viability of the ones he could get a hold of. Chrétien says that these cadaver-harvested stem cells are not being targeted for use in any kind of genetic disease therapies at the moment, which brings a sigh of relief to all those who fear a zombie apocalypse, but they could be very useful for clinical tests, where there are no ethical implications about their employment. Again, one of the creepiest ideas is that if the researchers learn enough about these stem cells and their ability to survive general mortality, maybe in the future you'll be able to donate your stem cells to help others after your death, just like you can do now when you donate your organs. Chrétien's group also recovered viable stem cells from mice 14 days after their death. Again, the creepiness factor is high, but those cells appeared to function properly after they were transplanted into living mice, helping regenerate damaged tissues. Although these findings could suggest that old corpses could supply stem cells for genetic therapies, Chrétien stated that, quote, "We are not saying that we will use old cadavers for treating patients for clinical applications. We won't have to wait so long for old cadavers. We can now just obtain cells from dead bodies only a few hours after death instead." Well, thanks, Dr. Chrétien, but why is that not at all comforting? The next story was reported to me first by my mother of all people, because she was worried about my health. Given that she told me first, I suspect the story is already widely distributed in the public press, and many of you may have already heard about this. But let me tell you again if you have heard it. The story, by Dr. Jonathan Sammet of the University of Wisconsin, is being reported this month in the American Journal of Respiratory and Critical Care Medicine. It concerns a statistical link between sleep apnea and a risk of cancer. Sleep apnea results when a flap of skin in the throat obstructs air intake. This may be due to obesity or a malformation, as is probably my case, of the structure of the throat or nasal cavities. These problems can halt breathing during sleep for at least 10 seconds at a time. That is mild apnea. Severe apnea is marked by frequent breathing stoppages that rouse a person from deep restorative sleep and cause the individual to gasp for air. What's more, the disruptions rob cells of needed oxygen, a condition called hypoxia. Research done years ago by another group showed that the skin cancer melanoma grew faster in mice that were subjected to intermittent hypoxia than it did in mice with normal oxygen flow. That work inspired Samet to investigate cancer incidence among participants in a long-term study that began in 1988. The 1,522 participants, who were ages 30 to 60 at the start of the study, underwent an overnight sleep examination at the outset. Those tests showed that 59 people had severe sleep apnea at the beginning of the study. So 23 years into the study in 2011, Samet found that those with severe apnea were 4.8 times as likely to have died of a cancer-related cause. Samet says that, quote, severe sleep apnea is defined as having an air interruption every other minute or more, which is pretty striking, unquote. Readings taken at the beginning of the original sleep study allowed the researchers to measure how much of the night each volunteer had spent in an oxygen-deficient state. After adjusting for other risk factors, those with the most severe hypoxia were nearly 9 times more likely to have died of cancer during the ensuing study years than those with normal oxygen blood. So it seems to me that the hypoxia may be involved in the induction of oncogenic activity. Well, I'm not going to whinge on about this, but now I can not only worry about getting Alzheimer's disease at some point in the future, but also lasting long enough without getting cancer to get Alzheimer's. Who was it who said, life, no one gets out alive? Anyway, next story. Quantum teleportation takes a leap forward. Chinese researchers, led by Dr. Jian Wei Pan, reported to the online journal Archive last month that they broke the record for the longest quantum teleportation yet recorded. The researchers entangled many photons together and teleported information 97 kilometers across a lake in China. That's more than 100 times farther than any other multi-photon teleportation experiment had ever been able to do. Pan also developed a way to track moving teleportation signals more accurately, which again could help to make the final result more robust. He says, quote, our results show that even with high loss ground-to-satellite uplink channels, quantum teleportation can be realized, unquote. If you're unsure what quantum teleportation is, let me explain. It is not exactly a Star Trek transporter, but it's still pretty cool. In quantum teleportation, two people, physicists for some reason that I do not understand, call them Alice and Bob, share one of a pair of entangled atomic particles. These can be photons or electrons or any other easily detected particles. Entangled particles mean that they share characteristics. Alice measures a property on her particle and then sends a note to Bob through normal, non-secure channels about what she did with her particle. Now remember that part of the reason for developing quantum teleportation is to create a perfectly secure method of communication. Bob then knows how to measure his own particle to match Alice's particle, and he does that. Bob's particle then possesses the information that was contained in Alice's particle because the two, Alice's and Bob's particles, were linked together. They were entangled. So the information has been teleported from Alice's lab to Bob's lab. Basically, these linked pairs of particles are entangled together in such a way that measuring a certain property on one instantly determines the same property for the other, even if they're separated by huge distances. The method is absolutely secure because you can only get the information if you have the partner for the entangled particle. If you have no partner, there's no way to get the information, even if you know how to treat another particle, as Alice did. Pan's next experiment will be to teleport signals to a satellite in low orbit around the Earth, and that is about 3 times farther than his current distant record for teleportation. The moral of the next story is no matter how right you are, you can be equally wrong. Those of you who have followed this podcast for the last couple of years will know I have predicted several times that the cost of sequencing a human genome will go below the magic $1,000 mark. I even reported a couple of months ago that this had finally come to pass, with a couple of breakthroughs in technology that allowed an entire human genome to be sequenced in parallel in just a few hours. I predicted this ability would change the world and medicine as we know it. Well, a new article in the magazine Forbes by Jim Golden reports on a lecture given by Dr. Mark Bogusky of Harvard Medical School at a recent healthcare conference in Boston. Unfortunately, you're now going to receive information about that lecture third hand, but I suspect it's probably fine. At any rate, Bogusky basically states in his lecture why I am completely full of bull in believing that the world will change with $1,000 genomes. Here's Bogusky's key message. Quote, "The time of the $1,000 genome meme is over. It served us well for years, driving advances in instrumentation, chemistry, and biology, but now it is reducing clinical credibility. It's time for it to leave the lexicon of healthcare. It has to go," unquote. So what is the problem with this meme? Well, here it is. The problem is no longer getting cheap sequence. The problem is what to do with your human DNA sequence once you have it. Here's the example given by Golden, or Bukowski, I'm not quite sure which it is. Every year, there are about 1.4 to 1.7 million new diagnoses of cancer in the United States, for example. Many of those cancer patients are familiar with the latest advances in healthcare technology reported in the media, including insights derived from medical data and personalized medicine. Yes, that includes those of you who listen to my monthly inanity here. So now it costs about $1,000 to sequence a genome. Let's say you have a tumor that needs to be treated. First problem is that you now need two genomes to be sequenced, both the tumor and your normal tissue, so that they can be compared against each other. Well, you've now doubled the cost of sequencing. And even that's not so bad, so we are now going to go to $2,000. But that will go down in the future as sequencing gets cheaper again. However, we have a different problem. Problem number two, you cannot just bring your DNA sequence to your family physician. He will look at you like you are nuts. He's not trained in that. DNA analysis is a specialty. You need to analyze all that data and have a molecular oncologist interpret that data in terms of clinical recommendation. That's going to cost you between $25,000 to $100,000, according to Bogusky. And that cost is not covered by insurance. Ouch. And that brings us to problem number three, and probably the hardest to overcome now because there is no analysis infrastructure yet. You have to know someone who will do that analysis, even for the exorbitant amounts that I just mentioned, and that is not easy to do. DNA molecular oncologists or DNA molecular pathologists are not a dime a dozen. Right now, there are only a few people in the world educated to do the data analysis. Bogusky says that if we set the total current sequencing capacity in the U.S. against the number of new cancers each year, we can only analyze the sequences of a few percent of those patients. To get your cancer genome sequenced and analyzed, you have to have a friend at a genome center who can do the work, perform the analysis, and work with a clinical oncologist to optimize therapy. Again, according to Bogusky, that's not going to change anytime soon. Sorry, folks, to dump cold water on what I thought was a new era dawning upon us, but it may be a while longer before we'll be able to take advantage of the awesome new technology that's out there. I suspect that to get really efficient at it, it's going to take some serious DNA analysis software to be written in the future. If everyone's DNA needs to be analyzed at some point, then we are going to have to rely more on expert systems, which can be ubiquitous, and less on human experts, which are not quite so ubiquitous. I guess we're going to see what the future holds. Speaking of being wrong, when the Kepler spacecraft finds a giant planet closely orbiting a star, there is a 1 in 3 chance that it's not really a planet at all. Yes, not all the exoplanets that we thought were planets are actually planets, if that makes any sense at all. These results were published in the online journal Archive last month by Dr. Claire Moutou at the University of Marseille. The results suggest that thousands of candidate planets may not be planets at all and need to be tested using some alternative method for discovering celestial objects in stellar orbits. Up to 35% of candidate giants snuggled close to bright stars are imposters, known in the planet hunting business as false positives. In order to detect planets, Kepler looks for the periodic dimming of starlight produced by planets passing between Earth and their home stars near the constellation Cygnus, the Swan. But not everything that darkens a star is a planet. Smaller stars, for example, might masquerade as a planet. Instead of detecting periodic twinkles, the authors of the new paper looked for tiny gyrations in host stars. These are the wiggles produced by orbiting planets' gravitational tugs. Since heavy, nearby planets yank more noticeably on their stars, the team focused on giant candidates with orbits of 25 days or less. Out of more than 2,300 possible planets, only 46 fell into that category where you could actually detect the wiggles. 11 of these were already known planets, and Mutu's team confirmed 9 more. Of the last 26 planetary candidates, there were 2 failed brown dwarf stars and 11 binary star systems, which were masquerading as planets. Mutu says, quote, "Brown dwarfs and binaries can clearly mimic a planetary transit event. That's why it's so important to distinguish these things when you study planets and transits from the Kepler mission," unquote. After distributing the unknowns according to the observed ratios of objects, the team arrived at the 35% false positive rate that were not planets. Now, if I was doing an experiment in a biology lab and I had a 35% error rate, I would not get any of my results published anywhere on Earth. But astronomers apparently have kind of a pass. They don't consider it a serious flaw for the Kepler spacecraft to have that 35% error rate. Mutu says, quote, "This false positive percentage is very low compared to all other transit programs," unquote. So I guess that lousy is acceptable when compared to even more lousy? Is that the take-home lesson from our astronomer colleagues? I suppose. Next story. For years, neuroscientists have agreed that human tongues perceive 4 basic tastes: sweet, sour, salty, and bitter, which we're all familiar with. In 2002, almost 100 years after it was discovered, the 5th receptors were confirmed for a taste called umami. Umami is commonly described as meatiness or savoriness. And now, 10 years later, umami is widely accepted as the 5th basic taste. So there are 5. More recently, neurobiologists and neuromolecular biologists have theorized that humans may have as many as 20 distinct receptors for such tastes as calcium, carbonation, starch, and even water. I reported on the water one a few months back. However, now one contender for a 6th basic taste has begun to stand out from all the rest of them, and that is fat. In March, a paper was published in the Journal of Lipid Research by Dr. Nada Umbrumrad of Washington University in St. Louis. And they presented evidence that humans can also taste fat. The study examined 21 people with a body mass index of 30 or more, considered clinically obese. And they tasted 3 solutions with a similarly viscous texture and were asked to identify the one that was different. One of the solutions given to the test subjects contained a bit of fatty oil. Participants whose bodies produce more of a protein called CD36 more often picked that solution out of the lineup, suggesting that they were more sensitive to the fatty acids. Researchers speculated that this CD36 protein made people more sensitive to the taste of fat, so that they perceive it in smaller amounts. If that's true, that would suggest a genetic basis for why some people crave fat more than others. It sounds like the hypothesis is that fat people taste fat more efficiently, which helps them to become fat. Okay. Abumrad said about this result, Quote, the take-home message is that we now know there is a fat taste component, and we cannot dismiss it. It exists in humans, but how it influences behavior and fat intake, we still don't know. Unquote. I want to end this segment with a recent story about science and scientists that I am pretty certain none of you has heard. If any of you think the scientists are above being petty, childish, and unfair, then think again. More often than not, scientists are serious jerks. Oddly enough, TV shows and movies are often way more correct about the personalities of scientists than about the science in any way. This story concerns Dr. David Sanders of Purdue University. I found the story in the journal Biotechniques, even though it has absolutely nothing to do with techniques of any kind. Dr. Sanders was married to Dr. Miriam Hassan, also of Purdue, and also a researcher. Doctors Sanders and Hassan did research in enzymology and protein structure. They had separate laboratories and separate grants, but they often collaborated because they had common interests. Additionally, since they were married, they were intimately acquainted with the work of the other. At one point in her work on determining the 3D structure of the enzyme butyrate kinase, Hassan hired a postdoctoral researcher by the name of Jiasheng Diao. Dr. Diao eventually diffracted crystals of butyrate kinase, and Hassan and Sanders published a paper on the crystallization of the enzyme, which just in itself is a major biochemical breakthrough. Diao discovered two different structures of the butyrate kinase. Those structures were submitted to the online International Protein Databank. Dr. Hassan was diagnosed with having a brain tumor about the time that Diao was hired. Just before she died of the tumor, Diao was finished with his work in Dr. Hassan's lab. No scientific paper had been written by Diao about the actual results of his protein structure analysis. But even though Hassan had passed away, Sanders was still planning to publish her final work on the enzyme. Since enzymatic work had been done in his laboratory as well, Dr. Sanders was in charge of writing the papers because it was his field of expertise. Sanders didn't hear from Diao for a while, and then he found out that Diao had submitted an article to the Journal of Molecular Biology. Now, whenever a paper is published, it is understood that if someone's name is on it, then they gave permission to use their data. Apparently, the paper by Diao included enzymology and structural biology that he did not perform. He put the other researchers' names on it, but they knew nothing about the publication. Sanders believes in only publishing high-quality papers that tell complete stories. The paper from Diao was A, not high quality, B, it did not tell the complete story. Diao wanted to publish two low-quality papers as opposed to one much more comprehensive paper, and C, worst of all, he broke a cardinal rule of science by not telling the supposed co-authors that their work was being published. When Sanders found out about Diao's essential betrayal to himself and his late wife, he contacted the editors of the journal Molecular Biology and explained the situation. They sent Sanders the reviews of the journal article and all the pertinent information about the publishing process to that point. Diao found out, in a paranoid fashion, accused Sanders of being one of the reviewers of the paper. Sanders laughed in his face, telling him it would be completely idiotic to review data from your own laboratory and never even point out to the editors that that was the case in a review. After taking a look at how far the publication process had actually gone, Sanders asked the editors to withdraw the paper for a variety of reasons, the major one being that not all the authors had agreed to the publication. The editors agreed, and the paper was withdrawn. When Diao found out about the withdrawal, he confronted Sanders and freaked out, screaming that he needed not just that publication for his career, but he needed to publish another paper based on the data he had gotten while in Hassan's lab. Sanders says, quote, he just kept repeating, I need two papers for my career. I need two papers. I must have two papers, unquote. Sanders says that after several meetings with Diao, he finally got a verbal agreement that only one high-quality paper would be published. That was agreed on by all the researchers who had been involved in the work. Sanders then started writing the scientific paper that would be submitted based on that work. After the Journal of Molecular Biology debacle, the journal and the university wanted to sanction Diao and launch a full-scale investigation against him. As I have said several times, you can't just take other people's data and publish it without their consent. By trying to publish other people's data without their consent, Diao could have been banned from any future scientific publication. It is a serious issue. Sanders said, quote, "In my foolishness, I said I didn't want an investigation and that I didn't want to punish him. I wanted to publish a paper with him. He made a mistake. He's sorry. Let's just move forward." And we then had a firm agreement that we would publish one paper, unquote. Basically, Sanders made the mistake of trusting a sociopath to do the right thing. Sanders found out a couple of months later that Diao had ignored the agreement that they'd had and submitted two low-quality papers just on the work he had done to two journals, the Journal of Bacteriology and another journal called Protein. So Diao could not be accused of not getting author permission again. He stripped out the data from the other researchers and submitted the papers. These were bare bones and pretty lousy in Sanders' opinion because they lacked the entire story, and also they made specious arguments, but apparently they were good enough for publication. Sanders said, quote, "When I learned about these papers in the Journal of Bacteriology and Proteins, I contacted the editors to tell them this was a collaborative project and he was using data and ideas generated in a collaboration. The Proteins one was held up for print publication, and the Journal of Bacteriology said that Purdue had to do an investigation. Their investigation found that it was indeed a collaboration, that my grants partially funded it, and that Purdue owned the data, and that I am fully in charge of the data, and that he cannot publish it without my consent. We sent that to the journals, and they retracted the papers." Unquote. Because Diao insists he needs two papers and refuses to cooperate with Sanders to publish just one decent paper, the upshot is that no paper is ever likely to be published on his work. This means that the good Dr. Diao will not get any papers out of his postdoctoral work with Dr. Hassan. Sanders says, quote, "We are not going to publish as far as I'm concerned. I could get someone to crystallize the protein from scratch and redo the whole project and publish it, but that's not fair to whoever I assigned to do that since it's already been done, and it's not right. It's a shame that it will not be published. As I said, there are a number of interesting elements to the structure." Unquote. Welcome to the world of scientific research, ladies and gentlemen. It is not always pretty. Unsurprisingly, Diao refused to speak with Biotechniques to give his side of the story, I suspect because he has no excuses for what he did other than his sociopathic need for two publications. Dr. Diao, if you ever listen to this podcast, I have chaired many, many search committees for my university, and if I ever see your name on a job application, let me tell you that it is not likely that you will ever get a job with us. Good luck out there. Well, that's all from me for now. As always, take care. Don't count your gas giants before they're hatched. Keep a close eye on your postdocs, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.